I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Majora Carter surprised everyone when she founded Sustainable South Bronx as a way to reclaim that community's quality of life. She's grown that into a movement, Green for All, that is using the green economy to move people out of poverty with job creation and job training, and she's here to tell us about it today. Robert Lighton has a deep understanding of job creation. His work as Vice President of Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation has produced a continuing series of studies that urge cities not to overlook the value of business startups in their economic development plans. We'll talk to Majora Carter and Robert Lighton today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Born, raised, and continuing to live and work in the South Bronx, Majora Carter travels the world in pursuit of resources to improve the quality of life in her environmentally challenged community. She founded Sustainable South Bronx in 2001 after writing a $1.25 million federal transportation grant to design the South Bronx Greenway with 11 miles of bike and pedestrian paths connecting neighborhoods to the rivers and to each other, securing more than $20 million to begin construction in 2008. She's created riverfront parks and green roofs, dramatically increased the number of trees in the South Bronx, worked to remove an underused expressway in favor of positive economic development, and successfully implemented one of the nation's first urban green-collar job training efforts, the Bronx Environmental Stewardship Training Program. It would be easy to say that the last thing those who want to help the South Bronx ought to be investing in are bike and pedestrian paths and trees. So what drew you to this cause?
Honestly, we don't do anything. We don't believe that there's anything new under the sun. I've been looking around the world for opportunities that could actually help uplift our community. Like, for example, I noticed in places like Amsterdam and parts, and definitely parts of Germany, that greenways and bike paths were actually used as part of the city's infrastructure, and that it was this really wonderful way to sort of bring people together, you know, create good methods of transportation for people to just get where they're going. And they also, especially when they were green to begin with, they also provided lots of wonderful opportunities to develop communities as well. And Bogota, Colombia is also a really great example of that. But the greening of our cities and our communities is just such an extraordinary thing, because there's been studies that came out of the University of Illinois and showed that what the effects of urban forestry can be. You know, everything from reducing stress levels to increasing girls' self-esteem to increasing community pride to reducing crime. Like, these things were incredibly innovative to me, and like really, especially when you applied them, you know, to a practical application within a city.
What were you doing when you first got involved in this movement?
Just honestly, trying to become a great filmmaker, and just living in my parents' house, and you know, up in the South Bronx. I'd had to move back home when I went to grad school, and it wasn't until I got, you know, news that the city and our state wanted to build this huge waste facility in our community that would have brought more than 40% of the city's municipal waste to our area, and then finding out that we already handled about 40% of the city's commercial waste, in addition to sewage treatment plants, sewage sludge pelletizing plants, tens of thousands of diesel truck traffic, and all of these things had an impact on our health. I just became politicized and realized that we would not be able to handle much more than that. And I wanted to be a part, you know, of solving those problems for our community and for the city at large.
And so the greening was an alternative to that?
Absolutely. First, we definitely had to advocate against the really sketchy policies that would create the kind of communities that would only allow us to be repositories for noxious facilities. But then we also had to be big thinkers and think, what else can we do here? What are the alternatives to some of this stuff that can actually provide benefits to our communities and the cities at large as well? And the greening of our community, starting with the waterfront, was just a really beautiful physical way so that people in our community and from outside of it could recognize that, you know, we were not just the garbage that was constantly placed on our backs, that we actually could be an important part of the city's infrastructure if we were allowed to actually develop in a way that rang true to what we wanted as a community and also what the city needed as well.
When you were advocating the planting of trees and pedestrian paths, bike paths, as an alternative, people must have come at you with the jobs argument. There are jobs involved in these in trucking this garbage. There are jobs involved in the in the treatment plant. Mm-hmm. How did you respond?
We worked on it in a couple ways. One, we absolutely acknowledge that industry and greenways were not mutually exclusive. So we had to agree with them on that. But then we realized it wasn't so much that we were anti-industry at all. It was what kind of industry were we interested in bringing in into our communities. And so the jobs argument, it doesn't really hold if you're talking about jobs that actually have a negative impact on people's quality of life and actually aren't the kind of jobs that actually provide career ladders. That's why the whole idea for a green job agenda, like such as the one that Van Jones and I with Starting Green for All, which is a strategy right now, we hope it becomes a movement to use the green economy to move people out of poverty so that it's the development of the kind of industries, you know, whether it's solar installation or green roof installation or any kind of green manufacturing. These are the kind of jobs that provide not just jobs but also entrepreneurial opportunities for the real innovative thinkers that are out there that want to use this green economy as a way to mitigate solid waste, to reduce energy, to provide renewable energy, all sorts of those things. And we as Americans have really just scratched the surface in terms of what are those opportunities that are out there that we are actually using to provide new opportunities for Americans.
The presidential contenders, including John McCain, are talking about green-collar jobs. You implemented one of the nation's first urban green-collar job training efforts. Tell me first, describe green-collar jobs.
We describe green-collar jobs as any kind of job that has a net benefit to the environment. And so we started our job training program as a way to help people understand that they had both a personal as well as a financial stake in the betterment of the environment. So anything you could include anything such as solar installations, green roof installations, to urban forest management, to brownfield remediation, all of those, you know, urban forest stewardship, all of those are green collar jobs, or building retrofits, green manufacturing, anything that it develops some kind of environmental service value. So when you're planting trees, you know, as opposed to, you know, as a stormwater mitigation technique and an air quality improvement technique, those are environmental services. We need to recognize that actually has value, as opposed to like looking only at a sewage treatment plant, which, you know, it does its job, but it's really costly. It's an end of pipe solution. It's a completely single use kind of thing. And it is, you know, an offense to the community that it's in, especially with the way that our country says it's okay to build them right now.
And are these jobs that exist today, or is this still a bit of a pipe dream?
No, I mean, it's definitely not a pipe dream. I mean, what we did back in the South Bronx, you know, when we started this program almost 5 years ago at this point, was we looked around at the lay of the land to see like what needed to be done. There were lots of community groups that were working on restoration on the Bronx River. So we realized that, you know, we could continue to have people come in and do this work, you know, from outside the community, or we can develop opportunities to train, you know, folks that desperately needed those jobs to begin with. So that's why the job training program happened. It's the same exact thing in terms of what we're working on right now. It's like assessing what's the lay of the land out there. Like, for example, in the South Bronx, you know, we handle an enormous amount of the city's recyclable materials. So what my agency did was create a feasibility study to create an eco-industrial park, also a concept borrowed from Europe, and all an eco-industrial park is it's a collection of businesses that use recycled materials as raw materials. And so that's mitigating solid waste. You know, actually the way that we want to design the facility, the greenway can actually go past it, so it's actually, you know, mutually beneficial to it. And also, you know, they're using barge and rail. trail, because the site that we located, actually you could use those two kind of transportation measures, so you can actually take trucks off the road, reducing air pollution problems, and creates hundreds and hundreds of jobs. Unfortunately, that piece of land was under some serious controversy because the city wanted to use it for a 2,000-bed jail.
Mm.
And so now we know that pollution and poverty are actually huge drivers as to what fills our jails right now. And are looking at how do we create more opportunities, reduce pollution, you know, reduce poverty, so that the incarceration rates are actually lower as well. And so that we are really concerned, like when we're, because I love the name of your show, Smart Cities, like how do you create opportunities for a smarter city? It's like if you know people are suffering from poverty and you know that it's often much easier for folks to participate in an illegal, any kind of illegal trade if there aren't real opportunities around for much more opportunities for people to participate in the legitimate economy, then people will go to the other one. And so what green collar jobs have an opportunity to do with us right now, or do for us as a country, is actually provide opportunities for those of many of our communities that were left behind in other traditional economies. And I think we're at a great time right now.
When you tackle this issue, it sounds as if you can't simply tackle it as a job training issue.
No.
But rather you have to tackle it as an economic development issue.
Absolutely.
An encouragement of certain industries, mm-hmm, to locate in certain places.
Absolutely.
And then get certain people, mm-hmm, who've had, lived in a particular set of circumstances to come into those jobs.
Yes.
Or to be trained for those jobs. I mean,
yes.
how do you get your arms wrapped around all of that?
One is the creation of policies that support just that. There needs to be, funding mechanisms and regulations in place that encourage, those kind of green collar job developments. And two, there does need to be training associated with it, because in many of the communities that we're working with, whether it's the South Bronx or Appalachia, many of these communities don't have these kind of skill sets just yet. We need to, make it a priority to make sure folks are getting that. But when they're trained, there needs to be places for folks to go to so that they can actually do the training, but actually put their training to use in a living wage job. So policy is an enormous, piece here right now, because it can't just happen, with a community group alone. And it also can't just happen, with the government deciding that they want to actually make it happen, although that would really, really help a lot.
Do you advocate for policy at a federal level? And if so, what sort of policies are you seeking?
We're advocating for it on pretty much every level of government at this point. We had a beautiful victory last year with the 2007 Energy Bill. Van and other partners within Green for All created a green jobs bill that brought about $125 million for green job training through the federal government. And it may not seem like an enormous amount of money considering the billions that went to the oil and coal industry, but I think it was an extraordinarily significant and symbolic step toward where we could go. And so I think the potential is really pretty amazing.
Tell me about Green for All.
Oh, Green for All is a strategy to use the green economy, this transitional green economy that we're in right now, to move people out of poverty. And we're doing that through a number of mechanisms. Like, one is absolutely looking at how do we impact it from the federal level. And the other one is also supporting, local initiatives so that there are opportunities for green jobs training as well. And you also helping, especially folks on the ground doing grassroots work, our first access to government is the city and their policies and their laws, and how does that impact us, and making sure that there are, folks that are well versed, on the ground and who have bought into this idea that this is the wave of the future, so that we are actually putting pressure, on our city governments or municipal governments to make sure that there are policies in place that are looking first at how we can use this as a real transitional moment for us to help people that, again, were pretty much isolated out of many of the more traditional, economic booms that we've experienced over the many years.
Have you written the perfect policy for local governments?
Actually, in the South Bronx, we've done some really incredible work. My agency was a co-founder of a group called SWIM, which stands for Stormwater Infrastructure Matters. And the goal was to make all of New York City's water swimmable by Clean Water Act standards. And you did that by actually dealing with the CSO or combined sewage outflows that actually flow into the river. Because actually, even a mild rain, you know, the sewage system actually overflows out into our waterways. And so really coming up with policies that we're really helping the city to look at, how about you institute some stormwater mitigation techniques called low-impact developments, such as green roofs, tree pits, lots of trees, and things of that nature, so that it's actually retaining stormwater. And we were really excited that we actually got signed into law. Intro 630 is now local law 630, which is basically tells the city that they have to take into account stormwater management issues through low impact developments, which automatically means that they also need to be looking at how jobs are created as a result of that. So we're really excited about that in particular.
Where do you get pushback to your efforts?
Sometimes the city. There's a lot of pushback. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, it's like anything. It's a new thing. You know, folks are really used to doing things the way that they've been doing it. And, you know, folks like me and Van are these like young upstarts thinking that we could actually change the world. And we believe it. And we know it's not going to be us alone. But the pushback, I think, really comes from it being a new thing and folks not feeling as though it's been tested, even though it has been tested. You know, like again, going back to the fact that I don't believe there's anything new under the sun, and I really have looked around the world to see what are some great opportunities. Like green roofs, for example, the oldest ones in Europe are like 50 years old. But you know, we've got some cities around this country are just like, well, we don't know if they'll work here. Like New York City, for example, like you know, they seem like a great idea, but they're not really tested. I mean, it's been 50 years. I think it's fine. You know, the average roof in New York City lasts about 5 years. So I'm not all that interested. I think it's a silly kind of argument, but it happens.
You were named a MacArthur Fellow. You won a genius grant. What did you do with the money? What did you do with the time?
The time? Oh, it just made it. I honestly felt that because I got that award that the pressure was on even more deeply. So I didn't take any time off at all. As a matter of fact, we used it to step up our efforts and really push the envelope to show that sustainable development in environmental justice communities actually should be the norm and not just in this exceptional, you know, little piece of history that we just witnessed with my getting a MacArthur.
I want to come back to the issue of green-collar jobs and training for green-collar jobs. So much of job training is poorly handled in this country. Just reading another report recently from Memphis where they're having a lot of problems. Those are unfortunately typical. Can't use all the money. Industry can't get any response from the people who are supposed to be providing the training, all the problems you know of. I'm wondering, when you begin to advocate for training around green-collar jobs, who does that training? Do the local career centers think, lady, you must be crazy?
I'm sure they do. But what we do is we bring in, you know, you have to train people, you know, to the highest and best standard that you can get them. So for us, it meant going to you know, universities in the New York, New Jersey, and tri-state area, you know, to find out where were the best places that we could possibly take our folks to learn, you know, about brownfield remediation, about water ecology, you know, about wetland restoration, about you know, any kind of flora and fauna that folks would come in contact with. And so those, and we bring in people to do that. We can't do that on our own. I mean, what our job is, we are the ones that are collecting this information so that we can get the absolute best resources to our trainees so that they will be the best prepared they possibly can be when they get out into the job market. And to speak to your point a little bit, like, yeah, I mean, all around the country, there are probably more people, and depending on where you go, there are more people in job training programs in a given area than have jobs, because that in and of itself is a market. But what we also do, which I think is different from a lot of other job training programs, is that we actually are the folks that are identifying trends, like where are the jobs out there? Like, for example, we realized that, you know, cemeteries was not like a place where we thought to initially look, but we realized that, you know, in many cemeteries, like even in the New York City area, there's like some tremendous landscaping, a lot of native species, a lot of like really, you know, highly ornamental kind of work that needs to be done, and you got to know what you're doing. And so now we're in a process of like working, you know, with them to make sure that we're getting our landscapers out to them. And again, this is another kind of trend. Another trend that's where we know is going to start happening, you know, is building retrofits. And so we're trying to develop partnerships so that we can actually make sure that we get, you know, our, you know, guys and gals that are going through our program, you know, up to speed with the kind of skills that they need so that they would actually be more marketable.
Do you ever worry that green collar jobs may be the next biotech or Silicon Valley, everyone chasing this one industry with only a few winners?
No, I don't. And it's because, number one, there's an extraordinary amount of work that needs to be done. And number two, this is the kind of stuff that absolutely can't be outsourced. So it will have to stay local if it's going to really do well. Like, you're going to need to see lots of pockets. So there's not just going to be one Silicon Valley. And because you need local folks to do this work, you know, I mean, sooner or later, like the pollution-based economy that we're dealing with right now, it's going to have to change. And it might not change tomorrow, but I think people's understanding, you know, of what is business as usual right now is going to change.
Majora Carter is founder of Sustainable South Bronx. After a short break, we'll get the latest on wellness destinations, something I obviously need this week, from National Geographic Traveler editor Keith Bellows. We'll also talk with Robert Lighton about a new study on entrepreneurs from the Kauffman Foundation. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. National Geographic Traveler editor Keith Bellows has the latest for us on wellness destinations. Keith, after 4 weeks of constant travel, a wellness destination sounds pretty good to me right now, as long as I can click my heels 3 times and get there. What qualifies as a wellness destination?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that probably one of the fastest growing areas in the world of travel is health. And in fact, the two biggest industries in the world, you could argue are health and travel. So it's only sort of fitting they come together. Wellness really is a more rounded word for all elements of making yourself feel better. So that could be spiritual wellness. It could be physical wellness. It could be psychic wellness. But it's the idea of sort of getting out of the slipstream of, you know, everyday life. And sort of retreating, but retreating in place. So in other words, for my money anyway, travel wellness is the idea of going someplace which is foreign, gets you out of your own sort of daily routine, but also restorative.
You focused on 3 such top destinations around the globe. Tell me about them.
Well, Karlovy Vara, which is in the Czech Republic, is sort of this classic. It's what we all think of when you hear the phrase, let's take the waters. So it's, you know, it's a long-standing place. It's been there for probably 100 years. It's a spa town, very much like, you know, Baden-Baden or Marienbad. It actually used to be called, Karlovy Vary was actually Carlsbad, which could be, apart from the beer, maybe more recognizable, for some people. But this is a place that, you know, kings went to, writers like Goethe, and artists and musicians like Brahms and Bach and so forth. And you do literally take the waters. In fact, you know, this is a place where you go and they sort of check you out. You know, they say, okay, you know, the doctor wants you to do some lymphatic drainage, or they want you to do acupuncture, or they want you to actually drink some of the water. You know, maybe you're going to do 400 milliliters of lukewarm water twice a day, or you're going to, you know, have a specific breakfast regimen, or you're going to have a particular massage therapy. But it's very, it's kind of old world, and it's in a majestic destination. I mean, Kalovivaara, you know, it's wooded paths, you know, very sort of contemplative places. You know, it's also you can get off into the restaurants and eat pork and potatoes and all that kind of stuff. But really, it's a place to just chill out. So that's one place. And that's your European experience, I guess. That's sort of the classic old world experience. And then you have, well, we all think of spiritualism. And so in Bangkok, which of course is probably one of the world's great places to go and play and reflect, you have Wat Pho, which is actually Bangkok's oldest and largest Buddhist temple complex. And the neat thing about this is, and Bangkok is one of my favorite places, and I didn't know about this place until I've been there a couple of times, but it's essentially drive-by therapy because you don't make a reservation, you don't do anything, but you just get in line, and you get in line with the backpackers and so forth, and there's a whole phalanx of massage therapists, and for $15, you can get a 45-minute massage. And now, you're not in this little tiny room with the wave machine going and the incense burning. You're next to 17 other people all in a line. But the massage is just as good, if not better, probably. And the great thing about that is that you're really walking in off the street in one of the most eclectic, thrilling, you know, vibrant cities in the world into this sort of little retreat, but doing it like the locals do it. I mean, this is where the locals go.
And then you found one in Colorado.
We did. The Shambhala, and we found a lot of them, by the way. We just use these as sort of representative. But Shambhala Mountain Center, which is in Red Feather Lakes, Colorado, which is about 110 miles, I think, from Denver. And this is a place, you know, it's in the mountains. It's a retreat center. It's 600 acres. It's about 8,000 feet up. It was in the 70s, a guy, a founder of Shambhala, which is a particular kind of meditative practice, sort of Tibetan Buddhist approach to meditation, founded this place, and now, of course, lo, these many years later, this is where you go for sort of what they call peaceful abiding meditation. Probably about 60 people there, you know, at any given time, anything from, you know, kids to you know, older folks. And as one of the therapists says, it's an alternative activity to our wild horse minds, which is a nice sort of image, especially when you're considering it. Colorado. But this is an area, excuse me, this is a place where you go to just simply be quiet, contemplate, breathe deeply, reflect, and get away. And I'm terribly skeptical of the sort of the crunchy granola approach to, you know, basically relaxing. But the friend who went there is a good friend of mine. Came back and she's a very meditative sort. But she said this is one of the most extraordinary experiences because it really is so much out in nature. It's not too crunchy granola, and you really do get a chance to sort of just be and reflect and not necessarily engage with the other 60 people who are there with you.
Should we expect wellness destinations necessarily to be expensive?
You know, the really interesting thing is, if you think about it, maybe 30 years ago, when someone said, oh, wellness, spirituality, getting in touch with yourself, you thought of sort of, you know, the, you know, Canyon Ranch. And that was sort of the benchmark in those days. Now, quite frankly, you could have a meditative retreat in your own backyard. I mean, there's no reason it has to be expensive. And what's happening now is the sort of democratization of wellness, the idea that it is in every city and every town. You know, for instance, I mean, my guess is that 10 years ago, you'd have to sort of hunt, even in a medium-sized city, for a yoga center. Now, you can probably get a yoga center in the tiniest town in Montana. The truth is that is becoming sort of common to our way of life. And so I think it all depends on what kind of standards you have. I mean, it's just like, do you need to stay at a Four Seasons or a Ritz? Or does a Motel 6 work for you? I mean, you're still sleeping. It's not like you need all the accoutrements. So I think it's really a matter of what works for you.
Do you think the fact that wellness is ubiquitous lessens its appeal as a travel option?
No. I think, in fact, what we're going to see is an explosion in the kind of trips where people are trying to marry leisure and escape with purpose. And so now you're seeing volunteer vacations and you're seeing experiential vacations. Well, there's nothing different between that and wellness destinations where, you know, for instance, right now you can fly to India and go to Delhi and probably be operated on by some of the best doctors in the world and have heart surgery and then go by plane, you know, 1,000 miles south and lie on a beach in an Ayurvedic retreat for 3 weeks. And the whole total cost of that would be about one-fifth of what it would cost to get a basic heart surgery at Johns Hopkins. So you've got a situation where you're marrying leisure, wellness, or health, and you know, and also saving money. So I think this is we're just beginning to see the emergence of this trend.
Keith, I also want to ask you about another story in the March issue of National Geographic Traveler on New York. Not exactly a contemplative destination. One of the joys of New York is that it is always changing. And for the March issue, you've written about the changes taking place below 14th Street. What will the traveler find there?
Well, you know, I had my own apartment down on East 7th, so I was right in the heart of this area, which really, you know, used to be the tenement district. It was where you would see a lot of, you know, Hasidic Jews who were selling their leather goods and their, you know, their clothing and so forth. And now, that whole area along East House and Delancey Street, has really emerged as one of the most exciting parts of New York, I think. You know, you've got the classic stuff like Katz's Deli where it's New York's oldest delicatessen. It's where Harry met Sally in the film. And then you've got like the Blue Moon Hotel, which is an old tenement building that an artist took over, really an act of love and saving an old building, which is right next to the Tenement Museum. And this is an area, you know, this is an area that like used to be hardcore. I mean, this is, you know, where a lot of the immigrants went. And now it's really a vital area, lots of really cool food places, not just the old ones like Katz's. A lot of very nifty new, clothing stores. Just, you know, little tiny, you know, places like the Balter Sales Company, the Bowery Restaurant Supply, where you've got very eclectic kinds of products. And then, you know, great bookstores, wonderful street markets, you know, old furniture stores and our antique stores. So it was an area that like 15 years ago, you know, a lot of people wouldn't really go into. Now it's the place I think that's the most reflective of what New York's all about, which is neighborhoods.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Robert Lighton is Vice President of Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation. He's also Director of Economic Studies and holder of the Cabot Family Chair in Economics at Brookings, where he has led a team of economists monitoring the global economy and seeking answers to economic policy issues in the U.S. and around the world. He's authored or co-authored more than 25 books and 200 articles for professional journals and magazines. He co-founded and served as the director of the AEI Brookings Joint Center on Regulatory Studies. Bob, you say that the U.S. economy is moving toward a more entrepreneurial form of capitalism. What does that mean?
It means that more of our growth is generated by entrepreneurial or newer companies. Now, this is very hard to measure, and it's more impressionistic than data-driven because we really don't have good data series on entrepreneurial enterprises. I mean, we know exactly how many new firms are started each year, but we don't know, let's say, in any given year, what's going to be the next Google or the next Microsoft. But if we look over the sweep of, let's say, the last 20 or 30 years, it's certainly apparent from just looking at just the stock ticker and just the way we go about our daily lives, that a lot of the innovation that characterizes our daily lives, the internet, information technology, hardware, software, biotech, a lot of these new things were all started by entrepreneurial enterprises, not by large established firms.
Well, if you try to calculate the role that new business startups play in our economy, can you do that either on the basis of revenues or employees?
Well, you could, but again, the government doesn't give us enough data to calculate what you want. I mean, about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a well-known researcher named David Birch who tried to quantify the importance of so-called gazelles in our economy, and a gazelle in his framework was defined as a firm that I think had grown something like 20% a year for 5 years or 4 years. And he had a database of such firms, but he's not doing it anymore. The government doesn't replicate it. And so we don't really have a good fix quantitatively on this, which is a major problem. There are other countries that actually do track their firms over time, but we don't.
I remember David and his work. In fact, I actually had David to speak a couple of times, and I've tried to look him up recently and couldn't find him, so I didn't know if anyone was still doing his work. Tell me why people start new businesses.
There are a variety of reasons. Obviously, some people start businesses because they don't have any other choice or they can't crack the labor market. This is most common among immigrant groups who come to the United States and often don't speak English initially and start smaller businesses themselves as a way of sustaining their livelihoods. But more common is the case of a person who starts either because they want to make more money, or more common is that people do it because they want to work for themselves. Some of these enterprises end up being multi-employer companies, and people who start out working for themselves end up employing lots of other people, but that's even a small fraction of all the people who start businesses. I'd say the dominant reason is people want more control over their own lives, even though living an entrepreneurial life is a tough life.
And it's a very tough life.
You become a slave to your business. And so, I mean, you think you have more control, but still, the dominant personality type of a person who starts a business is somebody who doesn't want to take orders from anybody else, and they want to control their own destiny.
Do we know what percentage of startups fail?
It depends on the study you look at. I think a sort of a good estimate is after 4 years, the failure rate is something like a third to a half. And then over 10 years, it's probably a half to two-thirds. And there are obviously some industries where the failure rate is higher than others. There's a conventional wisdom, you know, that restaurants don't survive very long. Still, I think a success rate after 4 years and a 50 to 60% rate is still pretty good. And then, of course, we see a lot of people, the real successful ones, are serial entrepreneurs. So they may have a successful company and sell it. And so it drops out of the database, but then they start something else. And so some of these failure rate statistics mask the fact that some people are getting out and in again and again and again.
So if the way the data are collected, you're saying that if an entrepreneur sells his business and that business then falls off the, as you say, the data map, it may appear as a failure, or it simply doesn't exist anymore, so it's counted as a failure?
Well, it just doesn't show up. If you're tracking businesses longitudinally, and you know they started in year one, and then you start, and then you go back and track them all and say, do they exist in year five? A firm that sells out in year three, which is a success by any measure, will not show up as a success in that counting, because all we're doing is trying to figure out who survived to year five, and some people got out, especially in the IT space. In the internet space, a lot of people want to start businesses and sell out. I have a good example. I've got my son is a senior in college, and one of his roommates has started and sold 11 businesses in the last 5 years. He's 21.
Wow.
He's a multimillionaire. And so he's got, you know, 10 or 11 successes, but you would show, if you were tracking each of his businesses, they'd all look like failures. But they're successes.
Interesting. In the earliest stages of a business, can you predict which will fail and which will grow?
That's a great question, and it's something that we're trying to get a fix on through a new database. It's actually downloadable from the Kauffman website. It's called the Kauffman Firm Survey. It's the first survey that's going to be longitudinal, in the sense we're going to follow firms over time. that's been done, as far as we know, in the United States. I mean, we wish the government would do it, but in the absence of the government having any money, we've gone ahead and commissioned ourselves. We've done a random survey of roughly 5,000 companies that were started in 2004. We're collecting lots of data about them, and we're going to follow them over the next several years, and we'll be able to hopefully get an answer to your question. Can't do it now. We have some very interesting facts from at least the first couple of years of data from that database. But what we hope is that researchers will see among the 100 or so answers to the questions that we have asked these people, they'll be able to figure out, hopefully, what correlates with what and be able to figure out exactly what contributes most to failure or success.
Do you have any notions about what you'll find?
No, I have some guesses. I mean, one of the things I think people will want to know is, does education, I mean, these are really input questions, like does education of the entrepreneur matter? Does the fact that the entrepreneur have other team members as opposed to going solo, does that matter? What kind of financing makes a difference? I mean, one of the interesting things we found out is that 90% of the firms in our survey in 2004, that started in 2004, 90% did not get outside equity money. They were all self-financed. So that means only 10% got outside money. And of those 10%, about a third got venture capital money. So that means only about 3% of the database got venture capital. And then the rest of the outside money comes from friends and family, or spouses. I guess that's family too. So make a long story short, we'd like to know, does the method of financing affect the probability of success? And, of course, we'll have other demographic data. We'll have age. We'll have sex. We'll have, ethnic group. We'll have race. We'll be able to tell which groups tend to be more successful than others, and through statistical analysis, hopefully researchers will be able to control for these things and figure out what's more important than others.
What are the challenges entrepreneurs in the U.S. face today?
Well, let's think about the good news first. It's easy to form a business in the United States. The costs of getting into a lot of business have fallen dramatically with the decline in the costs of information technology. I mean, a lot of businesses now can run on servers or on computers and printers that you can almost operate out of a home office. You don't have to have a big warehouse of a big computer department. And so for at least some businesses, the cost of entry has gone down. Some localities have made it easier to fill out all the forms, not all of them, but at least it's pretty easy. And certainly by comparison to other countries, the United States is an easy country to start a business in. So that's the good news. On the other side of the ledger, our entrepreneurs face a welter of regulation and potential litigation. We're a more litigious society than other countries, so that's a concern. I think a second concern increasingly is healthcare. Not only is it more expensive over time for entrepreneurs here to afford healthcare if they want to have employees, but if you're working for a large existing company and you're thinking about going on your own, you're facing a really difficult choice because you're going to leave the comfort of your employer-provided health care and you have to go on the individual market. And if you've got a pre-existing condition, which I think virtually everybody over 40 does, you are going to be at the mercy of the insurance industry on the self-insured market, and you may not find insurance. And so I think the so-called job lock problem for employees of larger companies who want to start new businesses, I think this is a big problem, and it's growing more significant. And I think I think those are probably the two of the most important hassles that entrepreneurs would mention, actually.
I've wondered why small businesses are not lobbying Congress every day to get a different health care plan in our country.
Well, small businesses do have lobbies that are organized for them, the National Federation of Independent Business, of course, and the Chamber of Commerce, although that includes larger firms. But I think there's a diversity of views about what ought to be done about health insurance. I think I'm just guessing. If you took a poll of most entrepreneurs, they probably would favor more market-oriented solutions, but not all of them. Maybe some of them would say, "Well, let's just have the government do everything, get this out of my bailiwick, and pick up the costs, and I don't have to worry about this." So maybe one of the reasons you don't see the lobbying is that there may be no consensus. Just as, by the way, there doesn't appear to be a big consensus yet in the country as a whole about what to do about health care, even though there's a lot of concern about it.
Does public policy in our country encourage or discourage new business startups?
Well, I think overall, net-net, we encourage it because we have a legal system that is reasonably stable, even though we're litigious. You can still get your property rights enforced here. You can get your contract rights enforced here. May take some time and some money, but we have a good legal system. It's pretty cheap to get into business. It doesn't take much time to do it. So we have an SBA that it guarantees lending at least for some portion of the population, which some people view as a plus.
Do you view it as a plus?
I think it's a mixed bag. It's not clear where we'd be without the SBA. I think in the current credit crunch in which we're involved in right now, I think a lot of people are happy to have an SBA around because without that guarantee, it may be difficult for smaller businesses to get financing. So probably on net, it's a plus. So public policy certainly in our country helps entrepreneurs, but as we've discussed, we have a regulatory system, we have a healthcare system that can act as a roadblock to entrepreneurship.
In a recent study from Kaufman, you proposed a number of public policy measures to support entrepreneurs, and they include, you've mentioned this, reforming healthcare, investing more in education, and adopting a more enlightened immigration policy. Explain how these measures would support entrepreneurs. You've really talked about healthcare.
Right.
What about investing in education and adopting a more enlightened immigration policy? Most people would not necessarily attach those to support for entrepreneurship.
Right. Well, let's take education first. It's not so much more dollars in education. It's, frankly, running a more entrepreneurial education system. We have a system that is very much command and control, as virtually everybody knows who sends their kids to school. There isn't much choice, although increasingly you can go to charter schools in different parts of the country, but we don't have enough choice. Principals who run their schools are not like entrepreneurs. They typically are taking orders. They don't have much control over hiring and firing because of union agreements. And so our schools, which are really, they're really educational enterprises, they're not allowed to operate entrepreneurially. And so is it any surprise that we have so many problems in education, and we don't have our entrepreneurial spirits guiding our schools and our kids about how to educate our kids better? And we have some woeful statistics. One of the most disconcerting, of course, is that something like 30% of ninth graders will not finish high school, which is unbelievable in the United States. We have mediocre to bad test scores on math and science, especially as kids get older. And yet in the 21st century, we're going to need math and science skills, whether you're an entrepreneur or not. Jobs are going to require more technical skills. We're going to be competing with kids from China, India, and other parts of the world that have much better math and science training. So if we want future businesses to be successful, we're going to need a more educated workforce, and the entrepreneurs themselves are going to have more training. And so that's why education is key to an entrepreneurial society. And we have a long way to go.
You do call, though, for more money invested in higher ed.
Yes, but again, I would say we want more entrepreneurial teaching. We want, for example, more creativity, more exposure to entrepreneurship to all students, not just business students in higher ed. So again, I would say that the primary emphasis in our policy prescriptions is not so much on money. It's on the way we do things, certainly with respect to education. Now let's take up immigration. Immigration, of course, is a very hot topic in the United States, very controversial. And most of the attention so far in the political arena is on low-skilled immigrants, specifically those from Mexico and South America. What we in our documents say is that totally forgotten in this whole debate about immigration are the higher-skilled immigrants, the people from around the world that come to America to get a college education. And here's the surprising fact. 25% of the successful high-tech businesses in the last decade were founded or co-founded by an immigrant. And most of those immigrants who came here to get an education, college degree or a PhD. So it is clearly to our advantage to have high-skilled immigrants come here. Yet since 9/11, it's been a lot more difficult for those kids to come here to get visas. And so as a result, they're going to Europe, they're going to Australia, or they're staying home, and this is not good for America. I mean, if we're having difficulty generating our own talented labor pool in the future, it is misguided, in our view, to shut the door to talented people from around the world who want to come here and get an education, many of whom found businesses and then employ other Americans when they're here. So we think there needs to be a major reform in immigration policy, specifically for high-skilled people. And what we would do, if we could play, play God for a minute, what we would do is we would say that any immigrant who comes here and gets a college or a graduate degree in science, technology, engineering, or math, they ought to get a permanent work visa in the United States and be able to stay here as long as they want. Because we ought to be holding out a carrot to the rest of the world for people to come here. We have great higher education in the United States. People flock from all over the world. I mean, that's where we have a comparative advantage. In fact, our schools are so good that we're branching around the rest of the world. American universities are in China. They're increasingly in the Arab part of the world, they're in Asia, and there are co-ventures in India. And so this is the one great American export that we have is education. We ought to be able to import people to come here and take advantage of that export and bring those people here to the United States.
One final question. If you were advising a local urban leader on how he or she could encourage the startup of businesses that would have a good chance of expansion, what would you tell them to do?
Well, I'm going to give them advice that a lot of them may not want to hear. But through a lot of research that we've done here at Kauffman, we think the most effective use of local dollars to encourage the growth of local business is to do the basics right. If you can get crime down, if you can solve your local infrastructure problems, if you can have decent schools, what that will do, and that's the basics, have nice parks and nice amenities, what that will do is either attract or retain the 25 to 34-year-old age group that are college-educated. That is the cohort that is most likely to lead to your future success. That's the cohort that's likely to form future businesses. And if you can attract or retain those people, that is the best indicator of whether or not you'll be entrepreneurial and successful.
Robert Lighton is Vice President of Research and Policy at the Kauffman Foundation. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.